For January the 19th, 2024, we talk about Pacific Drive, Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, Remnant 2, and much more. Welcome to Level 486. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Moxie.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. It's a rare three-style combo this time. Yeah. I at one point had a spreadsheet checking to see what the rarest combo was. I need to go take a look. It's probably something like
Cole by himself.
But, I mean, well, that's like a shiny type Mega Jala. I don't play Pokemon. I was trying to make a Pokemon joke.
I think it'd be me, Jala, and Dennis, maybe, would be the rarest combo. This one also feels rare. That's a lot of nonsense on the back end. It's good to have you here.
Yeah.
Dennis is in the ocean, and Jala is on a honeymoon trip. Not a honeymoon, an anniversary trip. There we go. Made that same mistake with Gary as well. So it is us here today. Ben, what's going on?
Not much. It feels weird to talk about the weather, but it was the coldest that it has ever been in Seattle this past weekend. So it was only quote unquote single degree temperatures, but that's like, people are not ready for that here. But
no,
on the bright side, it did not precipitate at all. And, it is now above freezing. So thumbs up.
At temperatures that low, like that eventually starts like that, that fucks with, like the public transit too, right? Even if there's no precipitation.
I think the buses are good. I rode the bus one of the days and it was like quite warm inside. So I was fine with that, but yeah. Some people's pipes got like bursts and stuff like that. Yeah.
That sucks, but you made it through. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just lots of like staying in. Keeping yourself entertained that way.
I actually went out every night, and two of the three nights I had Cuban sandwiches. So,
nice.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, showing him who's boss. Nice. Moxie, how about you?
So I'm in a similar boat. I am snowed in. Got a few inches of snow. It's 11 degrees down here, -4 wind chill. And in Alabama, that is recipe for shutdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, do they even have a snow emergency like system in place?
No, not really. they shut down the entire city is built around one a parkway, a series of overpasses that goes through the city. So they just kind of shut that down, and that effectively shuts down the city.
Yeah, no way in or out.
Yep.
Except combat. Yeah.
Although, more interesting, before we got snowed in, one of my friends has been doing a kind of a horror host event. So, you go in and, has a projector and projects up on the wall, old public domain, like B-horror movies.
Okay.
And then, he's all dressed up and does, commentary and kind of a mystery science theater type thing.
Okay.
Sounds like the Rocky B horror picture show.
Yes, exactly.
What movie was it?
So we watched, a episode of the old, like, 1940s Flash Gordon.
Okay.
Nice.
Which was interesting, but the main event was, White Zombie.
Yeah.
Which stars Bela Lugosi and is the first zombie movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And it's actually surprisingly good. He did have to say at the start, like, hey, this movie was made in, like, I don't know, like 40s or 50s.
Yeah, the concept of a zombie was still a Haitian folklore. Yeah.
Well, and it is like the Haitian style, like it's explicit, like zombies are not dead people, that sort of thing. But it's also like, there's like a couple people in blackface and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, you know, not real bad, but still some. Mm-hmm. Probably the most entertaining thing, though, is just the degree to which, one, the plot is straight up Dracula.
Yeah.
And then it's funny, the secondary villain that's kind of working with, you know, definitely not Dracula, despite being played by Dracula, is just a spitting image of Harry Houdini.
Okay. Hmm.
Which is kind of funny.
Huh.
And also, I'm sure, you know, this was intended, but in today's time, some kind of surprising homoerotic overtones.
Yeah.
You know, he, they abduct the equivalent of, was it Mina's, boyfriend? I forget, and, you know, kind of forget, completely about the, woman that they're ostensibly trying to, like, capture. Yo, she's escaping, and they're just kind of like, whatever.
Yeah,
but this dude is important. We must keep hold on to him.
Yeah, let's not look the other direction here. Yeah.
So, it was surprisingly good. Surprisingly high production value, stuff like that. So,
yeah. That's the thing about that was pre-code too. So, like. Mm-hmm. You know, not like it was going to be like super gory or whatever, but it could be challenging, you know?
Right. Yeah. And there was one scene that I'm sure was super risque at the time, where the woman is in like her evening gown, or, you know, her evening clothes that's basically
like real gauzy.
Yeah, it's like non-transparent full body lingerie, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there is a term for that, but like I'm sure at the time that was super like, you know, trying to get in the male audience type of thing.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. Like, oh, you can discern her figure beneath this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd be curious to know if it was made before or after the war, since that the 40s is a very like volatile decade. So
it was oh gosh, it was pre-code, so it would have been before like 33, something like that.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, because this was like still very. I'm trying to think. When did Haiti gain their independence?
Well,
well,
I mean, the Haitian Revolution was, I think, in the 1600s, and then
so it was before. Yeah. Just because like. All of the white characters basically, like, very explicitly are acting like the colonialists.
Right,
apparently they maybe weren't technically or whatever.
There was a slave uprising that that gained them independence from France. However, in the way that the conflict was resolved, Haiti was put in increasing amounts of debt in order to pay off the property, quote unquote, that was taken from them, and therefore fell in hawk to any number of colonial powers.
That would have been what was going on with this.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't they just recently like pay off that? Well, whatever.
I think they just recently were like, yeah, that's not happening or something like that.
Oh,
yeah, the Flash Gordon one actually was interesting in that because it was set, you know, what? It was 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't tell. It almost came across as being set like alternate history where World War II didn't happen or something.
Okay. I'm familiar with it just by I've never seen any of them.
Well, it's weird because like there's definitely some theming into it of like, you know, like alien stuff happens and like, oh, how will this impact the balance of power? Like, you know, do the Germans know about this? You know, kind of that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But there's
like
no
Indiana Jones.
But there's no explicit, like, I don't know. It was weird.
Yeah. Oh, so kind of like, no matter, No matter where a movie was set, if it was made in the 60s and 70s, it was still a Cold War movie.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I was super wrong about when the Haitian Revolution happened. That was 1791.
Mm.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. That sounds like a good time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I don't have an awful lot special. We've had a bad way of the weather up here. I had to go drive out early this morning to get like three towns over to get to an early dentist appointment to get my bite adjusted. Ooh. I've never had to have that done because I got fillings late last week, and then like just my mouth is closing weird. Like, what's going on? Like, yeah, I know you need to get your bite adjusted. I didn't realize that was going in with a drill and like shaping your teeth so the top and bottom so the top and bottom rows would fit together better.
Oh my
god. Dude, do you have shark teeth now?
I asked for just a couple at the front to try it out before I committed to the entire procedure.
Yeah, that's a smart way to go.
Yeah, and if it goes entirely wrong, I can either do, you know, jaws, or I can do what we talked about before, which is just two U-shaped implants, kind of like horseshoes. So I have a lot of options from this point. Yeah, no, but otherwise it's just been things are not as like, you know, locked down up here as they would be in places that are not used to it. I just can't be bothered with the cold.
So, oh yeah, no, totally.
So I've mostly just stuck around the house. Yeah, so that's what's happening. I think we should talk about video games because I was about to talk about video games, and this isn't when we do that. So why don't we do the regular kind of show? What with the grind, the multiplayer, and the end boss. And we can get started with
The Grind.
The Grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the last period of time or so. I'm going to go first because I have something new. I have something so new that it's not even out yet.
Oh, we might have the same new thing.
Did we now?
Maybe.
Okay. I'll say it and then you can either go, yeah, or moan.
Is it a demo?
No, it is a preview beta. Because all of this work doing video game criticism and commentary would have added up to nothing if I didn't have the legitimacy of getting pre-release code meant for game press. I decided for the first time I was going to ask a publisher for a code for their open preview event, and I got I actually streamed a preview of an upcoming game called Pacific Drive.
Oh, that looks so good.
Yeah. So this should be up when you're listening. It should still be up on the Duckfeed YouTube channel when it's there. It's not coming out until February, I think, 22nd. It's sometime mid-ish, late-ish February. This is, I forget when it was previewed, maybe at E3, something like that. It is a driving survival plus like eerie supernatural horror game. The concept is you are somebody who gets trapped in this place in the Pacific Northwest called the Olympia Exclusion Zone. And it's this place, you know, obviously alternate history or whatever, where sometime in the middle of the 20th century, this, you know, super science mega corporation caused an instability where all of these stalker slash shadow of Chernobyl anomalies kind of overtook the place. Complete like matter instability and things not necessarily cohering, everything acting very unpredictably. You get sucked in and immediately you find a beat up old station wagon. And, you know, by talking to the old timers who are like left over in the zone and trying to help you, this is a very special object. It's like an object of power from Control. This is called a remnant, where, you know, it is this, you know, object that is both imbued with some strange properties from the zone, but also ends up becoming bound to a person. It's your only way around the zone. And you set about trying to figure out how to escape. This game takes place from first person perspective, and you primarily drive, although you can get out and go explore and loot and pick stuff up. And I would say that this feels a little bit like a combination between like a Subnautica and a Dredge in terms of, you know, what you are doing is going on these little expeditions, you know, in this case, like selecting a, you know, particular sub map to go to either accomplish a particular mission or to just go and find parts for you to work up the upgrade tree, and repair the damage from your latest run, but also, you know, invest in making the car better so it can be more adaptable to the stuff that you know encounter, you know, these places where like the ground just, you know, kicks you up, right? Or where all of these, you know, old machines that have gone crazy, you know, there's like a big like flying squid kind of robot thing that that attacks, that has this big magnet that picks up the car and throws it.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah. So there's not anything specifically like hunting you. So it is hard to, you know, categorize it like as like straight up like a horror game. You know, it's more on the like eerie atmospheric side of things. Like, so, you know, shit's definitely weird.
So what I'm hearing is that you don't know what's hunting you yet.
Yeah. I mean, so the demo is like the first two story missions, and then it's just open for you to go and do little like sorties to go scrounge through cabins and like prefab trailers and stuff. That's there. What I think is really interesting about this, you know, the flavor is cool. And the map itself, the ways in which it gets hostile and the way that you have to navigate around these hazards, you know, feels very much kind of like a Death Stranding, you know, kind of deal, right? Like there's a little bit of SnowRunner in this where it's like, am I going to be able to make it up that hill? Right. You know, how am I going to proceed and route around this? All that stuff is really cool. And the like survival resource, you know, grab and churn kind of rhythm, that's tried and true. The thing that I think is really cool about this, is that each mission you go to, you know, in any of these maps, the only way out is you have to, gather up these, like energy cores that are around in order to power up the stabilizing machine or whatever inside the car. And then when you're ready to leave, when you're ready to go home, you activate the little jump stabilizer, and you have to pick one of these predefined points that is far enough away from you on the map to race to, right? And once this timer starts, you get like a battle royale style constricting, it's like a storm comes in, and then, you know, the safe circle that you can be in starts getting smaller and starts moving. This can happen to you. These storms can happen if you are if you take too much time anyway, but it cranks up to 11. Gotta hit that cliche. It goes wild when you, activate this and have to get away. And it is the first time that I personally have seen the constricting safe zone thing from a battle royale being used in a single player game in a way that makes things very, very kind of anxiety inducing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are we sure that this is not just like a prequel setup for like, oh, this is the origin of PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, and then we're going to have to like flip a table?
I'm pretty sure, unless the company is really hiding where they're getting money from or what have you. It's a small...
I'm just saying, we live in the darkest timeline.
This is true. What were you going to say, Ben?
That's an odd like matchup that I've never heard of before. Like, yeah, as you're saying, that being in a single-player game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Comparing it to Subnautica and Dredge is pretty high praise, though. Like, do you have like a sort of home base that you're running out from the car, or is the car essentially your base?
The car acts like a mobile base. You can install different things in the back of it. It's a station wagon, you know, so it has a roomy rear end. And Yeah, no, that was me just trying to get a title. That's not gonna work. your car can act like a mobile base. Like you have some storage, and you have like a crafting center. There is a home base that you go back to, where you have all of the dinguses that you used upgrade stuff with, right? So it's like your extended crafting vocabulary in the way that you use resources to unlock the tech tree, and also it is the place where you do repairs on your car. Hilariously, either you manufacture new panels to replace the ones that are damaged or lost, but the all-purpose repair this kind of thing, it's just this is basically like a little can of what amounts to spackle. And it's really satisfying because like when you use it, your guy just reaches into it with a putty knife and then just whip, like just slaps it on whatever you aim it at in order to like heal the car. But like I think to get at the heart of your question, I don't believe it is a base that you upgrade or build yourself. It is like a home map that you go to between missions.
Okay.
And the way things are structured, it really seems like later missions will have you because you're traveling around to this node base map to the different kind of pre-made levels that they have. Longer runs will have you staying away from home base for longer. Mm-hmm. And doing more of these kind of missions in a row to get further away and then possibly have to get back from that longer distance.
Mm-hmm.
Is what it seems like. I have nothing to base that on other than the way the node map looked. The part of it that was available to me versus the part that was, versus the entirety of it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
This sounds like a really interesting concept. Good.
So Ben, is this a accurate depiction of the Pacific Northwest?
I haven't seen the gameplay, but I mean, there's pine trees everywhere. So that's close enough, I guess.
That's halfway there. Yeah. I have a couple of bummers about it. Like the interface is not as good as it could be. Some things are not necessarily as discoverable as I would like. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of, oh boy, I've got this. The car is not shielding me from radiation as much as I think it should. In my crafting list, I can make something called a sealing kit. So, oh, that's probably what I need to seal off my car. Maybe the gaskets or whatever. No, that's not what that's for. So I just wasted those materials.
Wrong sealing.
Yeah. I think it's for like when you're doing more like engine maintenance.
Okay.
Yeah.
For water fording, maybe.
Maybe. I was looking for water fording, except, caulking it so no radiation would get in and cook me alive while I was driving.
Yeah. Radiation is a lot like water.
Yeah. I don't understand either of them.
Yeah.
So like interface and discoverability stuff is a little bit of a bummer to me, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. That is something that, because this is a game in the survival genre, I think maybe, if you have played a bunch of these, the assumption is like, oh, you play this kind of game with a wiki open anyway to figure out like what things do and, what your kind of build path should be. I always, when I play these games, am like hoping that I will find that each new one will be the game that breaks that. And none of them have known especially well, even like, the best of them, like Subnautica, have known especially well how to communicate, what particular use different craftables have, and especially like what craftables are intermediate steps to what else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I wonder how long it is before just like at the start of the game a link to the wiki pops up.
Might as well. So like it's neat. I enjoyed it. There were some like so I've never done this process before, but like when they sent over the code for the for the preview, they also sent over like a document that said, hey, like do things in the order that the tutorial tells you, because you'll get you'll get a progress lock if you break from it, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're still working it out. Obviously this is a month and change pre-release, but the concept seems pretty sound. I am curious to see how far up they will drive the menace with it. Right now it just seems to be, oh man, shit's really weird here. And it's the environment that's a danger. I wonder if there's going to be a more direct threat. It's definitely got me curious.
Yeah, I think comparing it to Subnautica, it's like the one of the strengths there is the diversity of biomes and how that kind of increases the stakes. And it's, I don't know if you can do that as easily in the PNW as the background. So,
yeah,
it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like a sweet concept. I definitely think I will follow that when it comes out to see how it gets reviewed.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's me. That's the only new thing I've been playing. Everything else has been homework. Or shit that I've talked about way too much already. So,
cool. Yeah.
What was it that you were playing? What demo did you play then?
So I also started playing something that isn't out yet. I played the demo for the new Prince of Persia game.
Oh shit!
Coming out on the Switch. This was mostly shout out to Mario. He referenced the game and said that it had gotten good reviews. I went and double checked. It's got like an 86 on Metacritic right now. It's getting released on, I think, the 18th, so a couple days after the recording of this. Okay. So I figured I'd just plug it in and try it out and play the demo. So I spent maybe half an hour to an hour on it. I haven't played many of the previous Prince of Persia games. I think I played like about the same amount of time and like one of the old school ones for like PS2 or something like that.
That's really funny.
There was
to hear.
Only like two good ones.
Okay.
It's very funny to hear the PS2 ones called the old school ones. Like, yeah. I know we're the same age, but like I remember playing Prince of Persia like on the Max at the Ontario Library.
Yeah. Oh yeah, three good ones if you count that one.
Yeah. So PS2 ones. So probably Sands of Time, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. But all that is to say is that I don't really have a lot of familiarity with the series, but. I do know that this one seems like it's a departure from the typical formula because this is a like Metroidvania style gameplay.
Yes.
And it is 2D. And I think, whereas I think the previous ones are 3D. So basically the closest comparison is the Metroid Dread, I think it feels pretty akin to that, except way different in presentation and skin on the game.
Yeah.
And then even like animation style seems like really unique where it seems like I'm not sure what's going on. I think the final boss story, I think I'm also going to be talking about Ubisoft in not a great light right now.
Yeah.
It seems like it feels much more like kind of like an indie sort of effort in the sense of it feels kind of similar to Hades in terms of the presentation where the art style of characters is like really differentiated and expressive and looks good. And it seems like they're going for like expressiveness over any sort of like gritty realism and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I've been avoiding like spoiling on this, but sure. I haven't seen it, but it, some of the stuff I heard was saying maybe they were doing some, throwbacks to the old rotoscope, of the original game. Does it seem like maybe that could be part of it?
It could be that. I guess I was being typically more cynical and uncharitable and was thinking that maybe they like had layoffs or something like that. And then because like the programming of the game, like the voice acting seems good, but there's not much like in terms of the presentation as far as like it's pretty minimal. Like that's why I compared it to Hades, where it's a minimal like the character will come up and, you know, the voice acting will be read and then the next person will come up.
Kind of yeah, it'll be a portrait. It's not like full cinematics where you're seeing, you know, the individual pores on anybody's
sure,
face.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
like this visual style doesn't, you know, like is not something that you arrive at by accident. It's really funny because based on the reviews that it's already getting, this is like the best reviewed Ubisoft game in like 5 years, pretty much. And it's also probably one of the cheapest games they've ever made in terms of overall budget, which is a lesson I hope they take to heart.
Yeah. Maybe,
possibly.
Yeah, it does seem very different than the kind of paint by numbers open world type game that they've done previously. But that said, it's not entirely original by itself. Like you can tell, it seems like they borrow heavily from things like Metroid. But that's fine.
It's iterating on a formula. Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that it's like in the setting that it is interesting. The combat system is interesting and somewhat complicated. Like they have things like, it's a dodge, but you can dodge in either way since it's 2D. So you can like slide under the person or slide backwards out of like attack range. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that, you know, like, depending upon what the enemy's attack is, that could be fatal in one direction and not in the other. But there's like interesting things with it where it's like you can slide, and then if you press attack at the end of it, you can like kick upwards. You kind of have a dash in midair that you can use. Mm-hmm. You can just do a regular combo tappa tappa. They don't even have like a heavy attack, regular attack sort of thing. You just have the regular attack.
Is there like a parry kind of system, yeah, like a perfect block kind of thing?
Yep, there's a parry system, and then you have like a arrow sort of thing, an arrow weapon that I think it's chakras at the beginning of the game, but it seems like it's something that can like plug out and plug in.
Yeah.
And then they have an interesting, so Moxie, since you said you didn't want spoilers, I won't spoil anything. Like, there's not really,
yeah,
much.
Yeah, it's
story.
not that big of a video. I've just been like not watching Let's Plays. That's all I mean.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. But I guess what I'll say is the combat system does seem like there's enough to it that it could scale and be interesting and like leaves like room for mastery and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They throw a couple of like bigger enemies at you in the demo, and where you do have to just do better than just like pressing the tap, tap, tap against them the entire time. Like, you have to actually think about what their attacks are and like when to get in and when to get out. So it seems like there could be something there. After an hour, I think I was kind of good on it. I'll probably wait and see what the reviews are. And if they are like very glowing, then I don't mind taking the plunge on it. But if they're kind of more reserved and it's more like a B type game, I might skip it. But it was at least interesting to try the demo, and there's, you know, anyone can play the demo if they want, if it interests them. So,
did you mess around with like the map screenshot kind of feature with that?
Yeah.
That's the thing that I've seen people kind of like going, you know, being really enthusiastic about, right?
Oh, I haven't heard of that. What's that?
Yeah. So it's a small feature where at any time you have a map similar to Metroid, it's like a 2D map. You can scroll all over the place and it shows where you've been. But any point in time in the game, you can take a screenshot of where you are and like basically tape it onto the mini map as like an icon. And so you can go back and look at that screenshot. So instead of like, they also give you like icons, you can put like treasure, like whatever that you can tag on the map as well. But if you want something more expressive than just like an icon, you can just take a literal screenshot and then go back and refer to that later.
Yeah. So it's not just like, oh, I left a dot here, or, oh, I can tell by the lack of an outline that this room goes further and something blocked me. You can take a screenshot and attach it to that, to that square. And then you can see like, oh, here's a gap that I need a double jump for to get over that. Mm-hmm. And so
this
when you get
is
the
what
double-
I need. In like La Mulana or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, people fill up notebooks playing La Mulana.
True.
Yeah. It's that's just
that's clever. That's really sharp.
It's a really good idea, and like all good ideas, it makes you. But once you see it or hear about it, it makes you wonder, why didn't we do this before?
Right,
why is this the first game to have figured this out?
Yeah, I think it could be because it's like something where, I mean, I guess it would work in like an open world game, I think would probably benefit from having something like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that.
Oh, apparently, I'm just pulling up some screenshots. Apparently, you can also get a optionally select a mode where some of this stuff is marked for you.
Cool.
So like if you come to like a locked door, it'll automatically mark it on your map and stuff.
Great.
Yeah, they do definitely do that. The map does automatically mark for you certain things if you come to it. Mm-hmm. But and then I guess like a small like nice feature too is like there's this kind of like golden like dust trail or something that will let you know where the main objective is, so you can like go in that direction. So that's helpful as well. Mm-hmm. So like they kind of mix up the biomes a little bit too, where it's like. The setting is you're kind of at like the base of a mountain, but there's some diversity in landscape, you know, even early on in the demo that kind of makes it more intriguing. It's not just kind of like all like God of War-y type theme or something like that. So
It also seems like, so a thing that has been true in the past is that everything in the Prince of Persia game looked really Arabic and sounded really Arabic, not making a distinction between Arab and Persian cultures. This one seems to actually say, like, hey, it's called Prince of Persia. Let's make it more like, you know, Persia.
Yeah.
You know, right. Which is cool.
So that's all I got for that one, but I got one more to talk about if there are any questions.
Yo, go for it.
One more
go
new one. So the other game I tried out this week is a game called Vertigo 2. This is a VR game, and it just released on PSVR like last week. It was originally supposed to come out like a month ago, but there was like a delay due to like a bug fix. Because this is a single developer and he's porting the game to PSVR. It's not even like creating new content in that sense. Not anyway, whatever. So mostly wanted to pick this up because it kind of came highly reviewed. Some of the articles that I follow or some of the sites that I follow about VR, I think there's one article that was criticizing the Game Awards for, I think, four of the five of the nominees being PSVR exclusive games and kind of ignoring like the greater VR world. And so they cited this as being like one of their favorite games of the year for last year for VR. So I put probably, I just got it this morning, so I probably put like maybe 2 or 3 hours into it today. But it's interesting. At various points you're saying like, oh, I can't believe one person made this. And then at other points you're like, man, this could use a little bit more polish here in this one place. And it kind of has like a high variance in quality throughout the experience so far. But the premise, I'm a little bit unsure of coming into the second game, having not played the first, but it's very like science fiction-y, kind of like there's like a portal that opens to like all these different dimensions, which kind of like justifies having like a lot of like zany and weird characters like all over the place. You play as a character who's it's kind of like similar to maybe a Half-Life 2 situation, where you're just kind of told by a robot that you need to go do something, and you're kind of a voiceless protagonist who's running through and just shooting things. And this game actually kind of I think, I forget what game it was I played, like Superland or something like that. That was like, that's like another game where you could tell it was made by like a single person. And there were a few places in the game where they like kind of have very lowbrow jokes or lowbrow references. I'm not saying this is exactly like that, but there are like places in the game where it's very definitively making kind of like a cheap, like Half-Life 2 joke or a portal joke and like referencing those things.
Yeah.
There's achievement for finding a portal gun that you can use as a gun. It's like a secret gun you can unlock. And I think it's called a Gordle pun. So that's kind of the level that's being operated at, where it's like, okay, sure. But, but at the same time, it's still impressive if a single person made this game, cause it is very expansive. So I think so far in the game, I think I've had like four guns that I've unlocked and maybe you've been in like two main different biomes. But that said, there are things that I've done in this game already that I haven't really done in other VR games, such as like kind of seamlessly going underwater into going into a helicopter and then using like a turret on the back of it, and then getting in a shootout with like robots and stuff, kind of like all one after another. It has like a pretty big like variance of experiences that you have. And so that's interesting. And yeah, like, for example, like the helicopter and like it, you feel like you're in like Star Wars, A New Hope or whatever, shooting down TIE fighters, where it's like, that could have been a game by itself, like that you could have made, but it's cool that that's just tied into this bigger game.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
It's still probably too early to tell, like, I think what I think of the game overall, but, I'll probably keep playing it and see what happens from here. But, yeah, but I appreciate, I guess, like the experience so far. It has similar to like Half-Life Alyx, it has like health packs everywhere. It's something that it's like a needle you grab and just shove into yourself to restore your health. Because sure,
it's either that or you drink
medicine
it.
Medicine works.
Yeah. Just get it in me somehow.
Yeah. But yeah, the guns feel good. And actually, the gun play is very similar to Resident Evil 4 Remake, where it's like, you have a pistol that you have to like manually put the ammunition back in. You have a shotgun that you have to like manually cock in order to reload it, that sort of thing. So that part seems cool. It's kind of fun playing these games like one after another and kind of like learning the vocabulary that works in VR games, mm-hmm. and kind of seeing that stuff kind of get built up and codified. But yeah, I think that's all I have to say about the game so far.
You fought any bosses yet?
No. No, there hasn't been any boss battles yet. So perhaps that will come. I know there's like, I don't know, like a dozen or something in the game. So I know I'll probably hit one eventually, but have not seen one yet.
Yeah. It looks fun. Like I like the visual style. Like that kind of thing works well in VR. Like the, bright and colorful kind of deal. If, you know, a game isn't going to fully commit to being as realistic as possible, having it be a fantastical world so you can see cool shit is a good alternative to that, to my mind.
Yeah. And there's little touches that are really nice that I haven't seen in other games. Like, for example, when you jam the health in you or whatever, like like your entire vision goes like slightly green or whatever as you're getting like pumped with health. But it's like, oh, that's a really fun thing in VR that I haven't seen other games do that much. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. One more thing to talk about after this one.
Okay.
And that is, I've continued playing Walkabout Mini Golf. That game is very awesome. I think what I've been doing is trying to do more completionist type things. So on at least the first screen of courses, I've gotten all the hidden golf balls on every hole.
Okay.
And I've unlocked, I think, the first three clubs, and I'm working on the back half to get the other three clubs.
Nice.
So that is pretty enjoyable. That game is just very fun.
It's really good. Yeah. I'd been playing that. I did a little bit more, a little bit more multiplayer, last week and this week. We need to play again.
Yeah.
And, the Labyrinth course, the one that's themed after, Jim Henson's Labyrinth is really good. Yeah.
That's awesome, but that's such a weird, like, tie-in to get, you know?
Yeah, it's because the developer like figured out exactly how they could trap me and Gary. So it's like, okay, both these MFers love mini golf. Oh, what's the missed obviously. Yeah, I should have missed at it. Oh, and Gary won't shut up about Labyrinth. All right, so let's do that.
I mean, Labyrinth is one of the greatest movies ever made. So
Labyrinth is very good. It's a really good course. And I like, I'll agree with you, Ben, like going and searching for the hidden balls, like actually engaging with the maps as 3D spaces more than just a place where mini golf incidentally happens is really rewarding.
And just for the listener, the way they do it is like there's a easy mode and a hard mode for all the courses. Is that true of the Mist and the Labyrinth as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And so on the easy course, you can find hidden golf balls on each hole. And it's usually like in between some rocks or somewhere you might not expect. But then on the hard course, instead of doing the same thing again, you have what they call like a fox hunt, which is where they'll give you some sort of clue that's somewhere on the entire map. It's not clear where. And so you're kind of ping-ponging all throughout the map. But that one, you're much more flying around and using that control, whereas you might not be doing that in the easy version. So that, I think it's cool that they layered it that way. So it's like, you know, if you're on the hard course, hopefully you have your like VR legs under you at that point.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit more forgiving if you're like flying around and stuff. So,
It's hard, you have to look for the balls.
To look for balls. It's hard to look for foxes,
I think.
Shrug?
We've gone off the rails.
Yeah, I know. We strayed into furry land.
Walkabout Mini Golf, VR, killer app. Everybody
that
needs to play
really
it.
Cool, actually.
It's really fun.
Yeah, and especially like if people on the network want to play it, yeah, the fact that it's so easy to crossplay makes it a very nice app for anybody who has VR. It doesn't matter what system it is.
Yeah,
I do find it funny that this is one of the VR games that actually has like walking around when golf is the perfect sport for just teleport to wherever your ball ends up. Mm-hmm. Hey, I mean, I realize they're doing other things and that sort of thing, but it's just kind of funny to me that it's like the one sport where it would have been real easy to do that, they're like, nah, we need to walk around.
Like, yeah. you can just play it like teleporting to where your ball's at, but like, I don't know. I like actually maneuvering around the maps because right. they're like well designed as whole 3D spaces, you know, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. opposed to, you know, in addition to having like really good, like, you know, whole design. Right.
So mm-hmm. do they do the mini golf thing where I'm trying to think how to say this. It's not just that, like, you know, you have your current mini golf hole in its environment, but, you know, in an actual course, they're kind of all twisting around each other and stuff like that.
Yep. It's like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, for example, like the last one's like a space level on the first page where it's like a space station with, you know, different trappings of that. And the holes are like weaving throughout all those.
Fuck that course. That I don't care if it's like only halfway up the listing. It's still so hard.
Yeah, it is. I mean, because I think it was, I don't know how the order of which they added holes, but I'm assuming that was like the last one on the base set when they released it. And that's why it's so difficult. I haven't played the hard mode on the course yet, but I'm sure that'll be not fun.
No, it's rough.
Yeah. Oh, and then another like praise for this too is like they lock the hard courses behind you having to get par or under on the easy course. Or the normal course in order to unlock it. So I think mm-hmm. that's a good way of doing it where it's like you have a certain sense of mastery about you before you kind of dive into the harder stuff.
Yeah, you're going to be familiar with that course's handful of gimmicks a little bit mm-hmm. better. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And the hard courses are meaningfully different, you know, like, mm-hmm. yeah, like the holes are either completely different and introduce a new mechanic, or they change the mechanic in such a way that it makes it a very different type of hole.
Yeah. So, and to go back and underline something that you kind of, you know, said, and I think bears repeating because now I'm officially a salesperson for this game.
Yeah.
cross-platform multiplayer is rare even on consoles, and any individual VR ecosystem does feel like it's its own kind of walled garden or whatever. Mm. It, literally, if the game is out for a system, anybody can play it with each other. Yeah. There's no like, you know, adding somebody as a friend, although you can do that. It's literally just meet me in this room name, meet me in the level 1, 2, 3. And then you both of you sign in using that code, and then you'll just be in the lobby, and then you can pick your game and go. Not everybody needs the DLC courses in order to play that. So like, Ben, you didn't have any of the DLC, and I still took you along to see the Mist course, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they get you with like avatars the same way as every other game, where it's in those courses, I don't get if I like find a lost ball or whatever, I don't get to keep that. I have to actually buy the map to get those. So
yes. Yeah.
Seems like a fair trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. I'm very happy that I've got you Walkabout Mini Golf pilled.
Yeah. And just a side note, I had two friends over like on Friday, and so I showed them the VR system, and that's what I sat them down and had them play first.
Nice. Like,
so easy to pick up. So yeah. Anyway, a lot of fun with that game.
Nice. Awesome. I don't have any questions about it. I play too much of it. Moxie, how about you?
Yeah. So I've got a couple of things. I checked out Remnant 2 on Game Pass. You know, really enjoyed the first one, although I haven't finished it yet, but, you know, really enjoyed it. So figured I'd, you know, check out the second one. And so far it stands up pretty well. It's one thing I like is that much more than most sequels I've seen, it is very much a direct continuation of the first game. Not to in the sense that like you're the same character or anything like that, but more in terms of like, you know, in the first game you've beaten the bad guys, and you know at the start of the second game, you know, it's still pretty explicit. You know, the bad guys have lost. They're just trying to like fuck everything up out of spite.
Okay. You know, they can't win, but they can, you know, make us lose type of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, similarly, it's much more, whereas the first game and, you know, most games will start out with a, you know, a fairly basic, you know, kind of roster of characters and premise, and then, you know, as more and more of the sci-fi and, you know, supernatural elements get introduced, you know, then kind of your roster will build up.
Mm-hmm.
However, in this, you know, you're basically getting to the, you know, home base from the first game. You know, I think it's technically like maybe a decade or two after, but still relatively, you know, shortly after. And so, you know, from the start, you know, there's like someone there that's, you know, an alien species from a different dimension that's just one of the vendors.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some there's someone who can you know, like see the future, you know that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting in that respect. It's kind of fun picking up all on that. The gameplay, I haven't been able to notice a ton different from the original game. This is sort of a, probably would be fair to call it like a shooter Souls-like.
Yeah, following after the first one, it's third-person shooter, Souls-like, that has like stamina-based dodging and the rhythm of shooting and reloading kind of mimics a little bit of the, you know, stamina for attacking kind of deal, with the right addition of, you know, per class abilities, some of which approximate spells.
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest changes this time around. Is in the first game, your starting class determined what ability you start out with, but you could equip any ability to any class. This time around, that's not the case. You pick from one of four starting classes, and although you very quickly unlock the ability to switch to any of those classes, and you also, I guess I should say, can equip two classes at a time, like their core abilities are not completely mix and match.
Right.
You know, whatever classes you're in, those are what you get.
Mm-hmm.
However, one of the interesting things, I've not gotten to this point yet, but there's apparently a lot of other classes that you can unlock as the game goes along, which is pretty cool. But at least so far, I think my favorite is this new class called the Handler, that basically you get a dog, like an attack dog that fights alongside you, which is very cool. It's an idea that I don't know why more games don't do. Also, it's very important that you can pet the dog.
Okay. like they put it in there to make that like a soloing class, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So when the big thing being like when you die, the dog can revive you, and also it can do some tanking.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's you know, that's a lot of fun. I really have enjoyed that change.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other classes?
So the other classes are, at least so far, there's a hunter that's, you know, kind of the range sniper class. There's a medic. And then there's the challenger that is a melee focus class.
Okay.
And I'm assuming, you know, there'll probably be lots of others. But then the world, you know, really emphasizes, you know, you're traveling to these alternate dimensions that just these complete alien worlds. And one of the big big mechanics from the first game is that the actual sequence of levels and bosses you face in a given world is randomized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of set up that you can, you know, reset the campaign and reroll with a new random selection while keeping all your gear and items and kind of your basic level of progress. And that's nice. And, you know, that way, that's how you kind of unlock things and sort of have a meta progression.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cool. And, you know, seems like I got the, it's like Yesha or something. That's kind of the forest level for the my first thing. Because the big thing they've added this time around is not only are the, you know, individual worlds randomized, but the order you play them in is randomized.
Huh.
Which is kind of interesting. I'm not sure quite yet how that's going to fit with this story. I'm assuming maybe it's a thing where you just, like, you know, there's some MacGuffin that requires you to beat all of them or something like that.
Yeah. I don't like that you, like, can't, like, I guess in the original it was you start out in the post-apocalyptic one that you have an option of like two that you could go to. Basically what I would prefer for this kind of game, and Elden Ring spoiled me on this, many options that I can work at any, you know, in any order. So like, say you've got a particular character build and the world that they give you, the first and only place you can go to, like you're not built for dealing with poison, and then they send you to poison swampland.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
yeah. Which is basically what I'm currently dealing with.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way to do that would be to reroll. Mm-hmm. Although I totally get what you're saying, that that's not nearly as satisfying as kind of having all the options laid out before you.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I'm a little mixed on is the first game had enemies scaling with your gear, and that was kind of a thing, and I think was kind of a questionable choice, but, you know, it was at least tolerable. This one, though, one of the kind of things is that enemies scale with your weapons, both in terms of HP they have and how much damage they deal. But you can no longer upgrade armor in the sequel. Which means the more you upgrade your weapons, the less effective your armor becomes.
Oh, huh.
Which seems kind of like, I don't know, an oversight. A lot of people I've heard have said, like, the overall scaling of, you know, you getting more options for putting together, you know, builds and synergies, you know, really outweighs that. But it still seems kind of unfortunate.
Right. Huh.
The last thing that, at least to me, has stood out is my favorite part of the first game was how they handled the post-apocalyptic elements, in that it's kind of set up, it's about, the game takes place about one generation after the apocalypse, so the, you know, people, you know, people that were like young adults in, you know, in the, you know, in the old world are, you know, maybe in like their 70s and 80s now.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, there's still people remember a lot of the, or, you know of a lot of how things work beforehand, but it's kind of like a game of telephone.
Right, right.
And so, like, one of the fun ones from the previous game is the hunter class, you know, reading between the lines, you know, after society collapsed, you know, people who were hunters, you know, were a big part of, like, how people got food and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But within the lore, the people have kind of interpreted it that to be that, like, hunters, you know, in the pre-collapse world were effectively like rangers.
Okay.
You know, from a fantasy type thing.
Right.
And, you know, believe that they could like commune with animals and, you know, all sorts of silly stuff like that.
Yeah. I don't befriend animals. I end animals.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So one of the things they continue with this is, you know, the various like kind of enclaves, that sort of thing, are called wards. And mm-hmm. in particular, Ward 13 is kind of your home base from the first game and, you know, also the second game. And at the start of the game, you're a traveler that's, you know, trying to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the funny things is that they've... it's not exactly clear why, but apparently, you know, people refer to Ward 13 for some reason as the North Pole, and have started to conflate. They're like, oh yeah, and it's run by like this old guy with a beard,
right?
And yeah. You know, and basically believe that Santa Claus runs the ward, but have no concept of like. You know, no concept of, like, what Christmas is or anything like that. Right. Have just kind of conflated these two things.
Nice.
And it's kind of funny, one of the characters from the first game, the guy that, responsible for all the, like, Dark Souls-style, like, time is breaking down shenanigans,
mm-hmm.
because of that, is effectively immortal, so when you...
No.
Meet him, he's basically a white guy with a huge beard, and you're just like, it was true.
Quick question about the new one. The thing that was cool in the first game was that it wasn't just Earth that had suffered this apocalypse at the hands of this what was it called, the Root or something like mm-hmm. that, like this creeping like foliage basically that overtook everything and then started spawning these monsters and stuff. Like the other dimensions that you went to were in various process, you know, and at various points in the process of having their own world end to this as well. Mm-hmm. Like this being further on the line, like, is that still the case? Like, are you even still fighting the Root, or is this you know, are the places you're going to still dealing with it?
Yeah, you're still fighting the Root, and at least the world I'm in, and this is kind of a neat plot point, you're kind of also dealing with how the after effects of the stuff you did from the first game kind of fucked stuff up.
Okay.
Because basically, you know, this world is very much like the, you know, primeval forest, you know, kind of those sorts of themes.
Yeah.
And is all about the balance between like life and death, and there's this life deity and this death deity.
Okay.
And in the in the first game, you basically ultimately what you're doing in that realm to get through it is you straight up like kill their death deity.
Okay.
And so like yeah. this time around, not only are the Root there, but you're also dealing with the after effects of you just like flipping the table from the first game.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that's going to be the same way. I'm really interested to see I think my favorite world from the first one was the one that was like the post-nuclear wasteland.
Oh, Rom?
Yeah, I think the like desert one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I really like that scenario. So I don't know if you go to it in this one, but that's definitely something I'd like to see more of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. I was gonna ask, are you playing this solo or are you playing this with like...
I'm playing this solo. Yep.
Okay. So are you the handler then?
Yep. Me and my doge.
Hell yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I meant to pick it up and check it out, but when we decided to shift around Bonfireside Chat and do it the way we're doing it now,
mm-hmm.
With Real Lich Hours, that just kind of fell back.
Yeah.
It'd be neat to do it eventually on Watch Out for Fireballs, but it would need to be kind of a multi-part thing.
Yeah. It definitely seems to me like I think it's something that's going to have staying power in that respect. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it. I guess what I'm saying is, to me, it feels like a game that gets enough of the core gameplay right that even if you were coming to it, you know, in a while where it wasn't necessarily in the zeitgeist, I feel like it would still have a lot of legs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the first one did pretty well, and this one seems to have done really well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. There's probably going to be expansions and stuff coming down the line.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Nice. Remnant 2. I don't know that I have any other questions on top of that. Did you have anything else?
Nope, that's all. Oh, actually, no, I'm sorry, I did. So, well, kind of. So I reinstalled Final Fantasy XIV.
14.
Yes, screw Roman letters. Roman numerals. only to find out that yesterday they had a 24-hour like maintenance.
Dough.
which is kind of bullshit. I have some feelings about that. But anyway, so I have just played like an hour or two of it. Just to get my feet wet again, I'm actually leveling up some of the crafting gathering classes.
Mm-hmm.
Which in this game are completely different classes.
Right. It's not just a skill that you specialize in.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of funny because the crafting or the gathering classes, at least, you know, have to go out into the world to gather, but, you know, don't have, real weapons or combat abilities. Mm-hmm. You just get like a straight up stealth ability.
Okay.
Which, you know, anything that's less than 4 levels higher than you just like straight up can't see you.
Mm-hmm.
So I like my new headcanon is that no one else in the world is actually having to fight these monsters because they're smart enough to just like leave them be. It's just your adventures and just these boneheads that are like charging out and punching everything they see.
Well, yeah, if they wanted to be alive, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing.
Exactly. But yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of cool that it seems like, you know, they try to have a little bit more sophistication to some of the things. So like the fishing mechanic, you know, you have different baits in different locations and stuff like that, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I did find it kind of funny, the guildmaster of the fishing thing at one point, he's just like, yeah, it's just like my grandpa used to say, fishing is just like philandering, you never know what you're gonna catch. It's like, wait, well, a minute, did you just make an STD joke?
Yes, he did. It's fantasy STD too, so you know it's wild.
Oh yeah. That's, you know, a thing, but no, that's really all I have so far. It's mm-hmm. You know, it's adorable, the music is great. I'm sure once I get to actually crafting the foods that it's going to be food porn.
No, yeah. Are you interested in doing a combat class at all, or is this strictly going to be a crafting thing for you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, the primary class I'm doing is monk. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of trying to, you know, get used to kind of navigating the world before I, get back into that. My right. goal is I eventually want to get, once you get to, level 60 in one of the base classes, there's a dancer class.
Okay.
That is like like chakrams and kind of bardic dances, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I that's why I eventually want to get to, but like I said, you have to get to level 60 first. It's kind of funny. This is not actually a criticism at all, but it's kind of funny. There is some part of me that is a little disappointed The game is super, super well optimized to where, you know, basically below the current expansion, just completing the story quests will get you to the level, to, you know, the level cap for pre-expansion.
Okay.
Which is awesome. I find myself, funnily enough, being a little bit disappointed that that means there's, like, no point whatsoever in trying to, like, optimize experience gains and stuff.
Oh, yeah. you're just from an older time of MMOs.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And my understanding is, you know, one of the things is you can switch to any of the classes and then level them up.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that, you know, that's kind of how it works, is when you decide you want to play another class, that's when you go and do all the side quests.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Huh. Cool. Well, I want to hear more when you start doing other stuff.
Yep.
Cool. Well, that sounds like a section to me.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where usually we ask you a question, but this time it's a free play, so you're asking us questions. We only have three because the two people who would post these are out, and Ben very thankfully reminded me that one of these should go up. So let's get through these. Callum asks, what is your favorite hidden gem of a game?
I can start off with this one. SNKRX, I think, is the most recent hidden gem, where it's like, I still don't think that's a game that popped off, but it is very, very well done, and it is a very small effort, but a very good achievement. It's like,
no.
I think it's as good and addictive as like Vampire Survivors, but it did not get the same sort of fame.
No.
So,
I mean, do you think that's because of like the low fidelity of it, even compared to?
Perhaps it's because it's more abstract. People like don't get as much flavor as it, but mechanically, it's just as good, if not better. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Moxie, how about you?
Come back to me. I'm blanking on the name of the game I want to talk about.
Frantically Googling.
Yep.
I talked about it last week in the news story, but Grime is one when it comes to either Metroidvania or Souls-likes, it happens to be a Metroidvania Souls-like, that I just never see anybody talk about, like, outside of our community. And that's because we did Bonfire Side Chat episodes about it and talked about it, you know, with really high praise. It's just, you know, like you don't see it talked up, really. At least I don't. And I think more people should play it because it is unique and good. All right. TikTok, Moxie.
I am wondering if they took it out of my Steam list. This is really weirding me out.
Describe it. I might be able to help you.
It's a indie tower defense.
Ooh.
Go on. Is it RPG elements to it?
RPG elements? I'm super sorry. This is.
Are you thinking of Orcs Must Die?
No, it's. Sorry, I'm going to have to take a rain check on this one.
Okay, you'll think about it. You'll remember it, before the end of the episode. I know.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Aaron writes, what would you consider a criminally underrated CRPG? Been enjoying my time with Disco Elysium, and I'm thinking Planescape Torment next.
All right, I have a question. What's the strict definition of CRPG?
Oh.
Yeah, so like a non-Final Fantasy style, you know, like turn-based, when you're in a random battle, you trade blows back and forth by selecting stuff out of a menu. Say that. So CRPG would be things like Baldur's Gate, Pillars of Eternity, things like the first Fallouts would be somewhere around there. Yeah. Yeah, Disco Elysium would be there. I mean, criminally underrated, like the Harebrained Scheme Shadowrun games. Like, people generally enjoy those, but I have, you know, I think that both Dragonfall and Hong Kong are both really good. I'm really happy that we did them for Watch Out for Fireballs, just to get me off my ass to play them. Just, you know, A, it's Shadowrun, which is always very good. B, incredibly good, like XCOM light tactical combat. And C, like really interesting stories with cool choices, where a bunch of stuff that you can do is honored.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like the, you know, the definitely I feel like I could say New Vegas because, you know, as one of the greatest games ever made, pretty much any rating of it would be underrated.
Right.
However, in terms of underrated as like a game everyone hasn't heard of before, I'm having trouble thinking of it, partially because CRPG actually isn't really one of my big genres.
Yeah.
I'll answer it this way. A game that is underrated in the sense that not a lot of people have rated it is Betrayal at Club Low. Betrayal at Club Low.
Yeah. I mean, especially from the Disco Elysium kind of a perspective where it's using tabletop rules in kind of more mundane situations.
Mundane.
Well, you know what I mean. You're trying to get into a dance club.
Whoa.
You're not like trying to, assemble the pieces of the reality shard in order
making pizza. You're doing turntable stuff. You're dancing. You're jumping over bars. Our lives are mundane compared to that game.
Yeah. Oh, good.
So I have a couple that I don't know if they count.
Okay. All right. Well, I can be the ultimate arbiter of this.
Yeah. That's how this works, right?
Yeah.
I Divine Cybermancy count?
I would say yeah. Okay. You know, it's more of an immersive sim, but like of immersive sims, it is more in the Deus Ex, like you've got super character customization stuff going on with it. Yeah. I would say I Divine Cybermancy counts.
Sweet. And the other one I would kind of pitch is The Incredible Adventures of Van Helsing, although that's pretty strongly action RPG.
Yeah, it's like a Diablo-like, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Also, I found the game I was trying to think of. It is Defender's Quest, Valley of the Forgotten.
Holy shit, that title. No wonder you couldn't pull it up. Good lord.
It's just kind of a fairly in a lot of ways fairly generic tower defense. Kind of its big thing though is each level, you know, there is a overall story, so you know, beginning and end of each level there's, you know, character conversations, that sort of thing. Both the level of animation and kind of the overall tone of the storytelling reminds me a lot of like, the Flash era.
Yeah, this feels this. I mean, especially the like character portraits and stuff. This feels very mid-2000s to me.
Yeah. And it is a very old game, but yeah. So that that would be one that I don't know that I would definitely say dude, you've got to play this. But you know, it is a lot of fun. Actually, another one would be Halcyon 6, which is kind of a Star Trek like DS9 inspired sort of base management type game that I haven't heard a ton of.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to call out that I like that the title that was hard to remember has Valley of the Forgotten in the name.
Yes.
Yep.
It was made to be forgotten. Yeah. Final one here. Jeremy writes, what's your favorite villain of all time? Doesn't need to be a video game. I mean, I'm just going to throw this out here. Obviously, you think, you know, the mind turns to Breaking Bad, and it would take an awful lot to unseat Skyler White as the No,
I appreciate that.
No. Walter White. Come on, it's Walter White.
So for me, I'm gonna say Daniel Plainview from There Will Be Blood.
Ah, shit, that's a really good one. He forgot his boy. Abandoned his boy. I forget.
I've abandoned my boy.
Yes. Yeah. Plainview. I mean, especially because he maps onto real life villainy as well.
Yeah.
This one's killing me because I really like well-written villains.
Okay.
However, I am, you know, put on the spot. I'm completely blanking. So there's a very good chance that next week I'm going to have to, like, do a thing and be like, so I finally thought of it. That said, if I'm restricting to video game villains, I think probably Voss from Far Cry, was it 3?
Right.
Yeah.
In particular, there is one of my favorite paced and delivered segments that I don't think gets enough recognition is, you know, there's a sequence where, you know, at the start of the game, he, you know, tries to kill you, that sort of thing. It doesn't work. He ultimately, you know, then midway through the game captures you and delivers this, you know, increasingly unhinged monologue about how, you know, the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over again and expecting
different results
and, you know, demanding and shouting at you whether, you know, you think he's insane, that sort of thing, and then proceeds to try to kill you again. It doesn't take. Mm-hmm. And then it's really well done. The next several missions end up being just, if you're just, you know, going critical path Johnny, a very short missions that keep ending with you in a death trap and ultimately escape it. Yeah. And then kind of the climax, you know, gets to where he's again setting you up and just you know, before he like pushes you into the trap, just gets right in your face and just says, hey, have I told you about the definition of insanity? It's just the delivery and like the pacing of the gameplay is just completely perfect to sell it.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. And makes sense to me anyway. And also, I mean, that actor, you know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I find it funny that like there's some sort of rule that Far Cry games can only hire like one really, really good actor.
Oh yeah, it's Elder Scrolls rules. Yeah.
Put it all on the villain. Yeah.
I mean, and let's be honest, if you're going to do that, the villain is the person that needs to be the amazing actor.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No question. Yeah. Cool. Well, that was Free Play Multiplayer. Thank you, everybody, for answering. In the future, if you'd like to participate in multiplayer, go to the Duckfeed community group on Facebook. Watch the prompts to go up, usually on Monday afternoons. I'm very sorry for the late posting this week.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games and how we feel about it. Ben, you alluded to your story here being about Ubisoft. What nonsense are they saying?
Yeah, so I kind of want to share this because on the one hand, I will say the title of this article is a bit clickbaity, but on the other hand, they still kind of suck. So basically, it's just an article that's talking about an interview that they had with Tremblay's last name, Philippe Tremblay, who's in charge of like the subscription service at Ubisoft. And the main thing that he's quoted on is that players need to feel comfortable about not owning their game. Mm-hmm. And so obviously not a great quote, not a great look. But in the full article or the full interview, he talks about like the idea of they want to move subscription service to be the main thing for people. And they want that kind of to be the default standard for how people play video games. And was just kind of commenting on how like with DVDs and CDs, you know, people are very used to owning those types of things in the past, but now they're okay with like streaming music. And so they kind of want to do the same thing with video games, but I could give him benefit of the doubt and maybe he's just talking about that sort of pattern, but not giving him the benefit of the doubt. Fuck you. Give me a game. I don't want subscription services. So, yeah,
I feel like the difference with streaming music is that like it's been however many decades and no one has like sunset the server on whether you can listen to the Beatles.
Yeah. And Ubisoft sunset shit all the time. So I don't know go ahead.
I will say, adding to the case of not giving them the benefit of the doubt, to play that demo I talked about earlier today, it forces you to like set up an account with them.
Good
and
Lord.
So I went through temp mail to set up a fake email to get that sort of thing and set up a fake account. Yeah. But still, it's like, yeah, I don't like that. So
no, I mean, I'm an outlier in this because I make a point of buying games physically whenever I can. You know, like indie games and stuff, you know, whatever. And Steam's been around long enough that, you know, there's all kinds of discussion that could be had about whether or not Steam gets the benefit of the doubt, but like they're established and they have not walked back actual accessibility for games in a way that makes me not trust them. Mm-hmm. Taking it into like the absolute like streaming model, you know, where you just do not. There's a contrarian who's going to come and say like, oh, read your software agreement. You don't technically own anything. It's a license to use, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I can flash my old PlayStation 3 and play every PS3 game that I own on it. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's also the fact that we tolerate streaming and movie or we tolerate music and movie streaming because piracy is also imminently available. Mm-hmm. Whereas games, because of always online stuff, again, which Ubisoft is kind of a pioneer in forcing on people, piracy is a little bit less of an option as a failsafe for bad, you know, for shitty business decisions. Yeah, this is like, you know, even if they are speaking pragmatically, they are the wrong messenger. Also, Ubisoft has a subscription service. What? Like, they're talking about that like they're established beloved. Like, oh, you know, everybody has, you know, you don't even think about it. You have your water hookup, your power hookup, your internet, and Ubisoft Plus, apparently.
I actually have used that before, and it's actually kind of weird in that, at least in my case, it was not an Ubisoft's benefit in that, like, I knew that most Ubisoft games I'm not going to want to play for more than a month. So instead of paying $70 for an Ubisoft game, I can just get a $15 subscription and immediately cancel it.
Yep.
I will say the article had a sick burn on him too, where they said, in the sentence, they said, in his word, quote, millions of users have flocked to Ubisoft's cloud-based streaming service since it launched.
At least
and
once.
They put millions in parentheses. So.
Well, there's also, this isn't exactly related, but there's a weird thing where apparently, like Netflix, the ad-supported version of Netflix, they're making tons more money than the subscription service.
Mm-hmm.
So now Netflix is like, oh shit, how do we get people to like not buy our subscriptions?
It's vile. I hate these incentives. I hate it here.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, fucking Ubisoft and Square kind of seem to be in this weird race to just like out disgusting each other. It's like a fucking John Waters movie.
Oh, wait till my
I was setting you up there. Yeah. What nonsense is Capcom getting up to?
So Capcom is adding DRM to their existing games,
yeah.
Which is kind of a bullshit thing because, you know, you would think you own a game. They're doing this through Steam, which, you know, again, is, you know, brings in kind of what you're talking about, you know, physical ownership versus whatever. But that's actually, I feel like, in some ways, a little bit bearing the lead. Because it sounds like the real reason they're doing this is they want to kill off mod support.
And the real reason they want to kill off mod support is because somebody left their horny Chun-Li naked mod on when they were playing Street Fighter VI in a tournament.
Yep. So, you know, prudism, American prudism, you know, strikes again.
Yeah. They're saying mods are basically no different than cheating. No, I just want to turn Mr. X into Thomas the Tank Engine. You bastards.
Maybe they're talking about like relationship type cheating.
Only we can see Chun-Li naked.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks. That is bad behavior on their part, and I hope they get slammed for it, because I don't know, mods are always a plus, you know. Do whatever you want with like cheat blocker or whatever in multiplayer, but like, fuck man, if it's single player and you're just playing for yourself and you want to see Chun-Li, go with God.
Yep. Yeah,
tangent, have you guys seen the Lethal Company mods that are out since we played it?
No. Do they have Chun-Li?
No. Naked Chun-Li's everywhere. It's wild. No, she's a monster. That's why. Anyway, no, there's like a bunch of mod support for it now where you can basically plug and play like, I don't know, tens of mods that can change. Like you can do cams that follow the monsters now. You can do infinite money. They added a whole bunch of emotes. It's basically like the internet decided to be the game developer for this game. Mm-hmm. So,
I could see this like, I know the Stalker community did a bunch of really awesome mods, and I could actually see a lot of those same concepts applying to Lethal Company.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I would love to have just like more. Like, I don't think Lethal Company has any like mutator effects on planets, does it?
What do you mean mutator? Oh, like the planet changes?
Yeah, like where, like, I don't know, this planet has like low gravity, or this planet, it's like acid rain. And so if you're outside for more than a few seconds, you start taking damage. Or
the game does that itself.
Does it do that? Okay.
Yeah.
That's something I could see mods adding to.
There's a mod that adds more exit doors in when you're inside, but that is because half of them are monsters that'll eat you.
Mimics?
Yeah.
I've got a story here after these two bummers. It is one that I'm pretty excited about. People who know me and have heard me talk for any amount of time know that I fucking love Frostpunk.
Love that Frostpunk is not a bummer.
Yeah.
No, it's so good.
We get to be the Ubisofts now.
Yeah. Frostpunk 2 was announced back in 2021. We've had to wait for a long time. This is one of the few games that I'm allowing myself to be excited about. Because I don't know, I trust this developer. All of the DLCs have been really good. There was a like an announcement trailer that gave away some details, like they're moving from coal power to oil power. Who knows what difference that is going to make. However, just today they have put out a new trailer, which I'll talk about, but also said that Frostpunk 2 is coming sometime in the first half of 2024. So that is sooner than I expected it to be. I am super excited about that. So Frostpunk is a like colony builder survival game. You're in a world that is overtaken by kind of this eternal and ever worsening winter, and you've got to keep this little colony alive while making a bunch of really harsh choices. The trailer is cut together super stressfully with all of these people making these impassioned appeals to you as the steward of this town. You know, steward, we must deal with the steward, blah, blah, blah. Just on and on, like everything that they're, you know, laying out as it shows you, you know, a new Frostpunk city, shows you a little bit of like some of the new ways that kind of buildings and units can be placed or whatever. But then it starts introducing new systems, which are some of which are brought over from some of the DLCs, like worker revolts, you know, and keeping them in. But the thing that seems really cool to me is in Frostpunk 1, if you wanted to enact a policy, right, such as whether or not human corpses are food here, that's just a little note on a tech tree, and legislation is on like a cooldown, right? So you always want to be advancing down those. In this one, those policies are handled by a legislature, so you can propose stuff, but like depending on how well you're doing, they can vote against you and override your vision for the colony.
That sounds like, have any of you guys seen Victoria 3?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like that.
Yeah. and also apparently that switch to oil-based stuff means that everything is much more unstable. Yeah, so like whole cities can go into meltdown and stuff. It looks like a fucking nightmare. It looks like I'm gonna have anxiety dreams about it, and I can't wait.
How is this a series that you're attracted to where this is just pure anxiety of the game?
I really think that it's put together very well.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
it's just one of your two favorite games are like this, and then the power washer simulator. It's like opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yep.
I think, yeah, one of my favorite things from the first game that I'm glad they're bringing back is the labor relations model in particular. I'm sure there are others, but it's the only game or something like that I've seen that manages to kind of make you have to care about both sides of the labor relationship without doing like an enlightened centrism, like both sidesism. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like you as the city manager, like you have relatively perfect information about what is coming, you know? So like, okay, we really need to pull these overnights, because if we don't, then a bunch of people are going to die. Right. Mm-hmm. But that comes at the cost, not just of people getting angry because I don't want to work. You know, it's not taking that stance, but like the risk of that is people will get pissed off. Their contentment will go down. But also like that is just unsafe. Workers who are, you know, being overextended, there is a higher chance of like an event happening where like a mine collapse occurs or something like that, or people get lost while hunting. So like it shows you like practical, you know, bringing up practical trade-offs, and like, you know, specifically like there are a couple of different, you know, there's the base game which has situations like that, but there are like at least two different DLCs, one of which is explicitly about class struggle.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah,
with the
yeah.
engineers versus the workers.
Yes. Yeah. And then the other one, the Last Autumn one, which is like very specifically about like negotiating with the labor. With a labor union, and introduces a new system of, you know, making appeasements, for lack of a better word, making concessions in order to keep the work going. It is a good model of that. And actually being worker conscious and planning better is a mode for success. Actually, it's just harder.
The one thing I hope they add is, well, in general, you know, the previous game, they kind of had you ultimately specced into kind of fascism or theocracy.
Yes.
I'd like to see them add more options, both just because, like, sequel, more stuff, cool. But also, that would be maybe my only complaint is that, I don't know, kind of the implicit message that, like, yep, those are our only options.
But they're not, because they're not. You can go down one road or the other. It's only after you pass a certain point that anything becomes not accessible to you, if I recall correctly.
True.
And then the different expansions or the different DLCs have like different axes on which you're working.
Do they?
Yeah. So it's like the base game and the scenarios that came with it. Those have the theocracy versus fascism, totalitarian kind of deal. But other ones have variants on that. So it just depends on the scenario that you're in. God, I want to play Frostpunk now.
Does Frostpunk have a mod scene?
No, I'm sure it does. I haven't delved into it very much.
I mean, that seems like something you could make, like some cool scenarios and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, I just haven't fucked around with it. So yeah, keeping an eye out for a release date. Frostpunk 2 looks really good. The trailer is harrowing, and also it looks great too. Like Frostpunk 2 is a very pretty game, and you know, the actual like gameplay that we see there appears to be a substantial upgrade from it, you know, for being a city builder.
Yeah, pretty lights on the grid now.
Yeah, looks like a big circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. Well, how do you all feel about buttoning it up?
buttons.
The credit. Thank you so much for listening to level number 486. We appreciate you taking the time. If you want to help out this show and the network, you can support us at patreon.com/duckfeedtv. And or you can rate or review this show in whatever podcast directory you happen to get it from, and tell your friends if you know that they like video games or are in the market for a podcast. Well, we're one of those. Is there anything I'm forgetting? No reason to extend this.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, I've been Cole Ross. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cole Ross.
I've been Moxie. You can find me on the level.
And I've been Ben Merkel.
And stick around for some titles. Okay, I only have one, which is jam the health in you.
That's pretty good. I likewise only have one, and I feel like it would need to be edited down, but it's a place where mini golf incidentally happens.
Okay.
Maybe like where mini golf incidentally happens, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, what you got, Ben?
I got two. I have, I don't befriend animals, I end animals. And I have fantasy STD.
I don't befriend animals, I end animals.
I'm good with that.
That's pretty good.
Cool. Animals aren't good with that, but I'm good with that.
No, they don't really have a say in things.
I mean, certainly not after you've ended them.
Well, yeah. Kind of takes the matter off the table. Cool. Well, it is decided.